Hello and welcome to the first episode of In the Know with Sowetan. My name is Sibonke Shoba. I'm excited to introduce my first guest, Deputy President Paul Mashatile. Thank you for coming, Deputy President, and welcome to In the Know.
Thank you very much, Bob Shoba. that's what I call you. I'm quite happy to be here. Firstly, let me congratulate you as the editor of the Sowetan.
Thank you.
Particularly as you celebrate 44 years.
Thank you.
It's been quite a journey. Quite a journey from those years when publications were banned by the apartheid regime. But, you know, Sowetan has survived.
Yes.
And I'm happy to be your guest as you launch this new initiative.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you
yes,
for coming.
Thank you so much.
Maybe on that, what is your first memory of the Sowetan?
Well, I recall that when we were young, there used to be a publication called The World.
Yes.
During our time, the editors, Percy Koboza, and of course, I think in the 80s, then Sowetan came about. I was still at Alexander High School. My memory at the time is that Sowetan was, published almost like a liberation publication. At some point, distributed for free. So we used to get it freely at the time for a while. But the good thing is that we suddenly had a relevant voice, especially after the unbanning, the banning of the World and other publications. So my recollection is that we then suddenly had this publication that was relevant to us at the time. And you know, in the 1980s, that was a time when there was very heightened organizational activity. You know, at the start of the youth congresses and so on. And we saw Sowetan as that voice that, you know, we could use to put across the ideas of the liberation movement.
It's still that kind of voice, but a lot has changed, Deputy President, since that time when it was first published in 1981, and there's a new technology, and that's why we are here today. I'm not interviewing you for a newspaper, and we are here for a podcast. We have just returned from Russia, a trip that you undertook in the last week. Was it to compensate the fact that the president didn't attend the Victory Day celebrations in Moscow?
Actually not. every year, President Putin convenes what is called the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, SPIF. It's been going on now for almost 28 years. So he invited us to that. He invited a lot of other heads of states. So the president asked me to go. So whilst I was there, of course, I had to take the opportunity to convey the apology of the president not being able to attend the Victory Day. But as you know, the Minister of Defense went. Our apology was accepted. But the good thing is that whilst we were planning to attend that forum, President Putin then elevated our visit to a state working visit. So I had to have bilateral discussion with the Prime Minister, with President Putin himself, and in both occasions, the Prime Minister as well as the President, they brought with them almost 10 ministers. So they took this very serious, because we had not been there at the level of the deputy president for almost 19 years. So for them, it was an opportunity to re-engage with us once again. So instead of just attending that forum, we had a full bilateral engagement in Moscow as well as St. Petersburg to discuss almost all issues. We put on the table the issues of energy, issues of mining, minerals, infrastructure, issues like how we want to improve our ports, our rail lines, and so on. So it became, you know, a very intense discussion. I was, from my side, with two ministers and five deputy ministers. So they were also able to engage with their counterparts. The Minister of Trade and Industry, Park Star, was there. Minister of Water and Sanitation, Pemi Majordina, was there. Deputy Minister of Infrastructure, Sihle Zikalala, was there. And Deputy Minister of Minerals was there. Deputy Minister of Agriculture, and of course, Deputy Minister of International Relations. So we were also a full delegation, of course, supported by government officials. So I can say in brief that it was a very successful a visit to Russia.
Before you jetted off to Russia, there was a controversy around the trips that government ministers and yourself do undertake. And I think the debate is not really about the importance of those trips, but it's around the cost of those trips. How do you make those trips cheaper? Because really some of the figures, you wonder if they are really justifiable.
Well, I'm glad you've raised that question, because let me explain it this way. The president and the deputy president don't get involved in logistics. There is a team in the presidency that sits and look at our trips. And it's a team that has the CFO in it. And they already have what I would say a framework on how they deal with that. For instance, when the president and deputy president travels, they have to find a presidential suite in a hotel, particularly because we are working. So what happens that, let's say, as I go to, let's take Japan, the one that was raised, they would look at hotels in a city where I'm going to have meetings. Maybe five hotels, then they'll decide, okay, which one has the facilities we need, whether it's a boardroom for me to meet with the ministers I'm traveling with, or ministers from that country, business people, etc. Are there facilities that we need, printers, desks to work, etc., etc. Now, you would find that the ultimate venue they will decide on might not be the cheapest. You get what I mean? So it might be the one that is closer to where the meetings are. It might be the one that has all the facilities. They then take a decision to say, we will use this one, of course, always conscious of the fact that we should not be extravagant.
Yes.
But one of the things that many people may not immediately be aware of is that some of these cities we go to are very expensive by their nature. I mean, if you go to Tokyo, very expensive city, same as the others that we've been to, like, you know, London, Paris.
Yes.
But we do take care of making sure that we are not extravagant. For instance, let me just make last example. When I visited China last year, 2023, the best way to get to where I was going was be to charter a flight, because the plane I have can't reach those destinations, same as the president sometime. And then I asked the office, so if I don't have a plane, I charter a plane, how much will it cost? And they said 18 million. So I said, 18 million just for one trip? They said, yeah, that's what it is. And I said to them, no, I'll travel commercial.
Yes.
So we do take care that we can save as much as we can. I mean, I could have said, yeah, well, deputy president must travel privately, therefore bring a chartered plane. But I said, no, I'll travel commercial. In fact, all my trips now internationally, I travel commercial because it's too expensive.
Yes.
But when it comes to venues, it's sometimes difficult to get a proper venue where your meetings are. So you'd find that cheaper venues are actually out of town.
Yeah.
Then you need to travel back. There's congestions in these cities and so on. But we agree with everybody who's critical about our expenses that we will do as much as we can, not to be extravagant, try and save as much as we can. It's quite difficult in some of these big cities.
Staying with international relations, there is a conflict taking place in the Middle East. There's talk of a ceasefire in Iran, but South Africa, South African Parliament, the last parliament, the previous parliament, adopted a motion to close the Israeli embassy in South Africa, because we believe the government believes that there is a genocide taking place in Gaza.
Yeah.
But also Israel has just attacked Iran on claims that they are building a nuclear weapon, but experts are saying that there is really no evidence to prove that. Why has South Africa not the government implemented that decision taken by Parliament
of closing
the embassy?
The embassy.
Yes.
Well, you know, government has considered that fact. It's not that we didn't want to do it, but
yes,
when we implement these decisions, sometimes they go in phases. You have to start with a particular action and see how far it takes you, and so and so on. I know some people wanted us to act there and there, but it's not something that we're ruling out. One of the challenges we had, we wanted to have a presence in that region. And we decided that if we close their embassy, they'll also close ours. And that locks us out of a region where we want to have a presence to be able to engage.
Yes.
And some people might say, no, well, you don't have to be there physically. But we felt, let's leave room for now to be able to engage, because that region is important for us. We want to see the people of Palestine, you know, having their independence. You know, we've been supporting that. That's why we went to the ICJ. So it's not something we're not ignoring Parliament.
Yes,
but government had to consider what it wants to do. In order to put pressure to Israel in that region, and we continue to do so. Even in Russia now, this is a matter we were discussing with the other leaders, whether Indonesia, China, you know, who were with us, the leaders from Oman, to say how do we manage this situation. I mean, President Putin in particular was accused for abandoning Iran. And people say, well, Iran are your friends. Why are you not helping them?
Yes.
And he was saying, no, I'm engaging with them.
Yes.
I've been speaking to the leadership of Iran. I've been speaking to the leadership of Israel. There's a particular way that sometimes leaders tend to do things. So one could have expected that, oh, maybe because Russia is a friend of Iran, they are going to run in there to try and be on the side of Iran and protect it. But they chose a different approach of engaging both sides to say there can be a peaceful resolution of this problem.
Yeah. You have many responsibilities as deputy president. I just want us to touch on those responsibilities. Yeah. The first one is the chair of the clearinghouse that manages the affairs of the GNU. I know there's a process that is currently taking place to kind of review how the GNU operates, the clearinghouse operates. But I want to talk about the GNU itself. What is your impression on the performance of non-ANC ministers? I know there are people who are saying, hey, these ministers are hardworking, and others are saying, I know they are opportunistic, they are taking credit for work done by previous ministers. What is your view?
Well, I was asked a question recently about the GNU, I think, so when I was addressing students at Harambee. And I said to them, if I were to score GNU, I'll give it 8 out of 10.
And that's generous.
Very generous, but it is because I observe its performance. There is this issue that some ministers are doing better than the others. It may well be true, but my observation as a leader of government business, I see ministers who are all performing. Others get more publicity than others. You know, there are ministers who are good at publicizing their work, what they are doing. There are others who are not very good at that, but doesn't mean they are not working. So it's always that challenge that, you know, some ministers, when they go and launch something, they already have the media there, everything. Some ministers don't, and it's across the board. It's not just ANC, for instance, versus DA. There are DA ministers who are not vocal when it comes to media, but there are others who are.
Yes.
You know, everything they touch, the media is there.
Yeah.
Of course, there was this argument that some of the things that the DA ministers are announcing were started by ANC ministers. It is true. But you can't fault them because, you know, when there's a new minister, that minister is now in charge, and they have to announce those things. And sometimes it will come across as if it's their new ideas, you know, because ministers don't necessarily want to give credit to the predecessor. They have arrived.
Yes.
So it's me, I've arrived, I'm doing this thing. But if you look at the GNU as a whole, it is working as a team. When we get to cabinet, we are one team.
Yes.
Responsible for implementation and accountable to the president. In the cabinet, there is no DA minister, ANC minister, Patriotic Alliance. No, it's one team. And everybody has accepted that. That's how we approach our work. And that has helped us to focus and really do the important things that we need to do. One of them is focus on the economy. Inclusive economy, create jobs, deal with challenges that people are facing in terms of the cost of living, but also make sure that the state itself is capable. We must build a developmental, ethical, capable state that must be able to deliver. That is what is happening, and GNU is working very hard. And I think, although there have been some problems in the past, especially with the VAT, the arguments, but beyond that, I think we're very focused.
Which leads me to my next question about the problems that you are referring to that have taken place. But I want your personal view now, not a party view or a government view. Given those problems that you are talking about, if it was up to you, would you have composed the GNU in its current form?
We had a lot of debate in the party itself. Mm. In fact, many people don't even know that the DA was not the first party we met when we're looking at how do we create a coalition government.
Mm.
But there was a principle underlying our approach, and that principle was, let's work with everybody.
Mm.
And once we agreed, we started approaching EFF, MK Party, DA, all 19 parties were met by ANC negotiators. Of course, in the course of those engagement, others decided no, we're not coming in. Mm. DA was one of those that said, we will come in.
Mm.
They tried, the DA, to say, no, but why don't we do a deal between the ANC and the DA?
Mm.
Because we've got the majority. Mm. If you take the ANC is 48 and the DA is 20-something, you know, we cross the 50-plus mark. So basically they're saying, well, we don't need these others. And we said, no. Mm. Let's bring everybody who is willing to come in.
Mm.
And I supported that view myself. And I was very clear that I think that's the best approach. You know, those who didn't want to come in, we tried to, you know, to persuade them. Because I wanted all these parties to come. I thought it would be good to have the EFF there, MK Party there. But the EFF said, well, as long as you have DA there, we're not coming.
Yeah.
Same as the MK Party.
Mm.
So it's not that we were picking and choosing.
Yes.
We basically say, let's work with everybody. I know that, you know, some people were saying, well, Mashatile does not want the DA, he prefers EFF. No, that's not true. I'm determined to work with anybody who was committed that we should work together. I knew that there will be quarrels in there. We know we don't come from the same school of thought as these parties. But a minimum program that we agreed on is a basis on which we move ahead. That's why I was able to pull together, you know, the clearinghouse mechanism. Some people say, well, has the clearinghouse succeeded? Has it failed? What is it doing?
Mm.
Now, the clearinghouse only meets when there's an issue referred to by the leaders.
Yes.
We did the Bella Act. And by the way, even in the GNU, we didn't have absolute consensus. The DA was still, I think the DA and the Freedom Front Plus were not agreeing with the language issue.
Mm.
But at the end, I said to them, guys, I think we need to move ahead now.
Yes.
We will note your concerns, but we have to move ahead. So some felt a bit being bulldozed, that they are not agreeing, particularly the DA, but we said, no, we need to move on. We need to, if we have a minimum agreement on moving ahead, let's move on. Sufficient consensus should be enough.
Mm.
We're not agreeing on everything, but we can move ahead, and we did. And you know, the schools are working. We're going ahead. Schools are open to all children. Many of our children want to learn in the language of their mother tongue, and that's what we were fighting for.
But there are suggestions that in an event that the current president does not finish his term, which we know is not far-fetched because the two previous presidents of the country didn't finish their terms, their second terms. There are suggestions that if that happens, and then you come in the event that you win the ANC presidency, and that then the GNU current form in its current form will change, and that fear also is found in the DA. We're saying that they have that fear of that happening.
No, I think they are just seeing ghosts. the GNU is working well. Anybody who comes in as a leader of the ANC would have no reason to change it if it's working well, me included. So people must relax. We are happy with the GNU, and as long as it continues to work in the way it works, no problem.
There are concerns about the ministers who seem not to be accounting to Parliament. Now I'm asking this question in your position as the leader of government business. So you have the Minister of State Security, Kumbuzo Ntshabeni, saying that her travels, her travel details and the costs are confidential, but you were able to finish yours. You have the Minister of Higher Education, Nobuhle Ngabane, being accused of misleading Parliament. How do you make sure that, or what are you going to do to make sure that these ministers actually do account to Parliament?
Well, firstly, all ministers must be accountable to Parliament. I remind them all the time as leader of government business, because the Speaker writes to me and say, this minister has not answered questions, this minister has not shown up in parliamentary committees and so on. Then I remind them.
Yes.
In fact, every time cabinets meet, every 2 weeks, I give a report on our work with Parliament. So I'm expecting them to be accountable. And now I've heard the reason of the Minister of State Security was that some of the work they do is confidential, and therefore she's willing to disclose that to the committee. To the extent that that is the case, the committee will deal with it. I'm sure things like travel shouldn't really be secret and confidential, but you know, we'll hear what the explanation is. We expect all ministers to be accountable.
Yes.
The president goes to Parliament to answer questions and answer everything. So the ministers can't be exceptions.
Yes.
The deputy president answers questions. The ministers must also answer questions, all of them, whether ANC, DA, they must answer. So we're going to hear what is the story about the issue of state security. If the minister was asked things that are confidential, of course she'll be right to say no, those can only be reported to the Joint Standing Committee, because that's how Parliament has accepted that issues of state security are also reported to that committee, which is confidential. But it doesn't mean every work that the Minister of State Security is doing is confidential. So we will need to separate the issues.
Yeah, we are also the chair of the Justice and Crime Prevention Cluster Committee.
Yeah.
one of the priorities there is fighting corruption. With the allegations of corruption against senior people in government, you have allegations against the Minister of Human Settlements related to VBS. There are investigations around the Minister of State Security related to her time as a municipal manager in Limpopo. And then there are also allegations that were published yesterday by News 24 that suggests that your sister-in-law is a business partner of Moses Tembe, who just recently won the lotto contract. How do people believe that government is committed in fighting corruption when there are these allegations against senior people in government?
Well, you know, allegations are allegations. The important thing is that they must be put to test. So those ministers you referred to, as far as I recall, they did appear before portfolio committees. Maybe the matters have not been finalized, but I remember that they did. Even in my case, there were allegations before I responded to what is called the Ethics Committee in Parliament. I've seen the recent issue about my sister-in-law. Now, my sister-in-law is a South African who has a right to do business. She doesn't do business with the presidency at the Union Building. This issue of the lot has run somewhere far away from us. For the Minister of Trade and Industry is responsible for that. They report to him, not to me. So I think it's unfair to put this as an issue. So it means any South African in this count who knows me can do business just purely because they know me. I don't think it's correct. When there's conflict must be real. If I was responsible for the lotto, I'm the one who's taking the decision, I would say, yes, there is conflict because there's my sister-in-law is part of this. But I'm not responsible for that. Very far from it. So it can be a conflict. And if people think there's real conflict, let them go to court. Maybe the court can show that there is conflict. I don't see it because I'm not involved in that area of work.
Is Mr. Tembe your friend?
Yes, he is.
Were you aware that he is a business partner with your sister-in-law?
I was not even aware of that.
I think, Mr. Mashati, the conflict that people see is because you are a senior person in government and ministers... By nature, ministers will then have discussions with the top people, the president, the deputy president, and then I think the problem comes to where people then say this person is very influential in government and holds this influential position and is capable of influencing this decision. I'm not saying that you did, but I'm saying that is out there. That's what out there in the public, that you are then capable of doing that. I think that is why it is a matter of concern, and that's why it was a story.
Yeah, but it doesn't make it correct. Not right.
Yes.
Because you see, the problem is that there are so many people who know me in this country. Family, got children, cousins, friends. Where must they do business? In Zimbabwe, out of this country, they can do business in this as long as I'm not involved, not because they know me. Because once you say Mr. Mashatile is capable of influencing, even if he's sitting in his house, it's unfair. You must be able to say he went there to interfere. Now, the chairperson of the National Lottery Commission says they were not influenced by anybody. Why can't we believe him?
Well, why are there always these allegations around you? Why do you think that's the case, that there are always these allegations? If it's not your sister-in-law, it's your son-in-law. If it's not your son-in-law, it's your friend, other friend, Edwin Sodi. Why do you think there are always these allegations around you?
How do I know? There's no way of me knowing why are people after me. I do my work. I focus. I've been in government for, well, as long as I can remember, close to 30 years. I've run departments in Gauteng, spent 15 years in the Gauteng government. I've been to national government, not now. There's no single department I've run where the Auditor General came and said, you know, there was a problem with your department. You are accused of having done this or this wrong. So I don't know where these allegations come from. People just go around picking stuff. And I don't know what their motive is. They only would know why. They are making these allegations. If I've done something wrong, I would be the first to accept, to say, here I did something wrong. But if I've not, I'm not going to accept that. Doesn't matter how many times people make allegations, I'm not going to accept it.
Moving to an issue that I know that you're passionate about, the issue of local government. Last time we spoke, you spoke at length about the district model. Now there's a new minister and he is proposing major reforms in local government that will, if they are approved, will see the number of municipalities reduced. But he's also proposing that councillors and mayors draw their salaries from national government to give the municipal coffers a reprieve. What is your view on these proposals?
We're going to discuss them. He did indicate that he's going to bring them through to cabinet. Local government needs attention. So he is correct. I mean, there are municipalities that are completely dysfunctional. And therefore, it's in the minister's purview and right to say, I think we need to do something about it. The issue of merging municipalities was discussed in the past. It may be something that we re-look at again, particularly where you think a municipality has no tax base, has no ability to operate as an entity. You might want to merge it with others. But those proposals are going to come in a comprehensive way to say, how do we improve? Because in some instances, we're also going to look at the caliber of the officials in the municipality, right from management, but also to look at the caliber of councillors and people that gets deployed in this sector. But local government needs a huge revamp, almost overhaul in many instances, and we will engage with the proposal of the minister once he is ready to bring them.
And the other role, you are chairing the interministerial committee that is organizing the national dialogue. The foundations that are involved in the in preparing for the dialogue have estimated that the price tag will be around 700 million rands. Your office has confirmed that, and there was a quote that said that democracy is not cheap. What's your view on the cost? There is an outcry out there that maybe the cost is too high.
Yes, it is. It is high. Remember what has happened here, and I'm still going to get more briefing on it. But what has happened is that because we work with other stakeholders, they themselves made input on what they think should be done. And one of those proposals is that you can't just have a conference. You need to go down to wards, engage with people, understand what their issues are. And I think that's what has created a lot of costs. Because once you go to every ward in this country, and you need people to go and engage with citizens and understand their wishes, their challenges. It's going to involve a lot of cost. So we may need to rethink that approach to be able to say, maybe there's a way in which we can get this information and cut these costs. So we have not finally as government approved the costs. And remember, this, a lot of these proposals come from the other stakeholders we work with. We work with foundations of some of our former leaders, NGOs and so on. And they have a right to make proposals on how they think the dialogue should be arranged. But it is costly. The current proposal on the table is costly. I think the mistake is that people thought, you know, it was government officials who were just sitting and say, we need 700 million. No, it was not. It was not the case. The government officials received proposals, some of which were already costed by other stakeholders. Says, for this to succeed, this is what we need. And when they calculate, it comes to that. So, we're probably going to cut it down by changing the format. We've now called the convention, which will be on the 15th of August. We will use the convention to say exactly how must we manage this, given the fact that we must also manage costs. So we will say to other stakeholders, look, maybe we don't have to do all this consultation in wards and get people running all over the country. They must travel, they must do this. Maybe let's relook at the approach. We can still get the information we need from many South Africans, maybe without necessarily, you know, employing people to go all over the country and therefore be able to cut costs. But we'll definitely look at it and ensure that costs are not ridiculous.
It's 70 years on Thursday since South Africans met in Cape Town in the Congress of the People and crafted a document that says this is South Africa we want. And then there was CODESA. And now we are going to another national dialogue. Is this an admission that we have really not realized the clauses in the Freedom Charter that were drafted 70 years ago?
My sense is that yes, we've got the Freedom Charter. In fact, if you look at the South African Constitution and the, a lot that we have been doing, we're really following the Freedom Charter in a sense. The people shall govern, you know, all national groups shall have equal rights, the land shall be shared amongst those who work it, etc. So the implementation of government program is based on that. Then we had CODESA, where we then agreed on, you know, how do we build one nation. That's still on the agenda. I think the national dialogue is an admission that we need to recharge. We have traveled this road this far, but things are not, you know, as good as we wanted them to be.
Yes.
Unemployment is rising, crime, all these challenges that we see. So in a sense, we are saying, let's go back. But let's go back as all South Africans. Let's not leave anybody behind and say, what do we think is going wrong? Why are we not achieving this ideal society as decided upon in Cape Town? Why is government not working in a way we thought it should at CODESA? So let's go back. Let's sit together and say, maybe this is where the problem is. Some people say, well, maybe we don't have a capable state. Maybe people who are working in government are not well trained. They don't have the right skills. other people will say, well, you as leaders, you are not engaging enough with the masses on the ground. People feel that you are aloof. Maybe you need to go back. So we will hear. National Dialogue is going to help us to really understand what are the challenges that South Africans are facing now, and how do we come out of that? And when we come back, we must have something that we collectively own. It must not be imposed. It must not be, no, government had the lekgotla and they say, these are the challenge of South Africa and these are the solution. We want everybody there, the people from the leaders who have the foundations, the NGOs, for all of us to say, yes, indeed, this is true. And indeed, this is what we must do together.
Yes.
And I think that's what the National Dialogue is all about. It's not, and it shouldn't be, a talk shop. And you are quite right. We don't want another conference for the sake of it. It must be something when we come from it, things must change in this country.
I'd like us to touch on ANC matters. So I'd like you to put on your ANC Deputy President the cap for a few minutes. The ANC has issued an instruction to its members to refrain from discussing succession.
Succession.
But as you know, people do talk. So there are people who are suggesting that maybe because a lot of ANC leaders are embroiled in one scandal or the other, maybe there might be trust issues going to the next elections, and maybe you need someone who comes from outside of ANC structures. What is your view on that?
Well, that discussion has not been brought into the ANC structures. I read about it in the newspapers. I don't know who these ANC people are who think like that. All I can say is that the ANC was never led by outsiders. It won't succeed. Leaders of the ANC are people who have been schooled in the politics of the ANC, who grew up there, who know its dynamics. I don't understand how an outsider can come in and unite the ANC. It will have to be a leader who grew up in the ANC.
A person like the CAF president, Patrice Motsepe, do you regard him as an outsider or someone who grew up in the ANC?
Well, Patrice, as far as I know, has been involved in the politics of the ANC. I can't say whether he's, you know, a branch member somewhere. Maybe he is. If he's a member of the ANC, of course, he can participate in any activities of the ANC, including being elected in positions of the ANC. But there must never be a notion that the leadership of the ANC can be resolved by bringing someone who's never been part of the ANC, particularly in its leadership structures. It won't work.
When the reports about a possible Patrice Motsepe candidacy, the Secretary General of the ANC came out and attacked him and said all kinds of things, that suggesting that he must stick to football. And it comes at a time where the ANC has said shouldn't talk about succession, but also this is someone who has not indicated whether the reports or the rumors about the possibility of him running for ANC presidents are true or not. But the Secretary General of the ANC just came out and just attacked him. Do you think that was handled in a proper manner? And also, is it not one of the problems that the ANC has always identified, the problem of gatekeeping? I've read many reports of the ANC. They point to a problem of gatekeeping, people in the ANC who think that they are the ones who are entitled to lead, and then they they sabotage or close the door for other possible leaders, and also talks to the other problem that the ANC has identified, which is arrogance. Do you think this matter was handled properly by the Secretary General of the ANC?
Well, let me not enter into the relationship of the Secretary General and Patrice. I don't know how they relate. I don't know what prompted that response. The Secretary General, of course, have the responsibility to remind all of us that it's not time yet to talk about succession. And to the extent that he was cautioning all those who are, you know, throwing names of everybody, that it's not the time to do that. And I would have left it at that, really, to say it's not the time. But once the Secretary General personally addressed, you know, Patrice Motsepe, you know, that's not the area I want to enter, because, as you say, it sounded more personal than anything else. Maybe when I have an opportunity to talk to the SG, he will take me into confidence. What was happening there?
Speaking of relations, you say you don't know what's the relationship between the Secretary General and Dr. Motsepe. What is your relationship with Dr. Motsepe? Have you spoken to him about these reports that he's going to stand for the presidency of the ANC?
In fact, we have not had an opportunity to talk, but I regard him as a friend. Every time we meet with Patrice, you know, we greet each other as, you know, my brother. You know, he likes this thing of saying, you will say to me, Paul Wakuhai, and I'll say my brother. So we will talk at some point. He has been busy traveling. I've been traveling. But there'll still be time, because elections of ANC leadership are only in 2027. So there is enough time. I'm sure I will have an opportunity to meet with my brother.
Is he someone you can work with?
Yeah, most definitely. I've worked with Patrice. When I was a Treasurer General, we spent a lot of time together.
Yesterday, the ANC and the SACP had a bilateral of the officials. I don't want to make you my source about what took place there. But there is this problem of the SACP having announced that they are going to contest the elections. And now all parties are preparing for the elections, are holding meetings to prepare for the elections at the regional level. And you have this issue of dual membership. How is ANC going to handle the issue of dual membership? How is the ANC going to discuss its election strategy and plans in the presence of people who hold membership of the SACP?
In fact, in the bilateral meeting yesterday, that's exactly what we discussed. We've agreed that the Secretary General will lead a team of the Secretariat to try and refine some of the issues that were raised in the meeting, including that issue, including the issue of the SACP, you know, contesting elections separate from the ANC. That issue was on the table, and the SACP made it clear to us that it's a decision of their Congress, which, as a leadership, they can't change. So we have agreed that, okay, given that situation, let's look at how we're going to work together as an alliance, and we'll meet again. The Alliance Political Council will meet sooner, probably before August, if possible, once the secretariat is ready with a solution. The important thing that we really emphasized yesterday when the president closed the meeting, he said, let's make sure we're not divided. Let's try and unite and stick together. So if we can find a modality where all of us can participate, the ANC, the SACP, without dividing ourselves, that's the route we will choose, because many in the ANC are members of the Communist Party as well. So you're talking about one people.
Including yourself, if I'm not
mistaken. Including myself. Yes. I'm still a member of the SACP. I was the General Secretary in the Southern Transvaal for many years. And I still pay my dues to the SACP. So it's difficult to make members of the ANC choose. And that's what has created this difficulty. And the Secretary General is going to lead the team to see how we resolve it. It's a difficult one.
Is it not exactly where this is headed? Because you can't... I can imagine it's going to be very difficult to discuss an election strategy in the presence of someone who's contesting the same elections.
Yeah, so those are some of the issues that this team is going to look at. How, because normally we strategize as the alliance and then say, okay, these are the candidates we are putting up. Now, if we're going to contest the same space, how do we work? How do we do it? We are hoping that when the team led by the SG comes back to us in a month or 2 months' time, they would have found a solution of keeping the alliance intact, but allowing all of us to participate in a manner that is not going to break the alliance or create disunity of the alliance.
Yeah. And my last question, Deputy President, there was a shooting incident that involved your convoy on the freeway. There are reports that suggest that the ballistic report on the incidents reveals that the damage of the windscreen was a result of stray shotgun pellets, and that we were not really the target. Do you accept that report, or do you still believe that there was an intention to cause harm?
Well, I've seen that report, and the police officers who came to see me said they are going to further look into the matter. But as far as they said to me, look, you were not the target. You were caught in strays. I accept the report because they have made the investigation. But they then said we are looking further at the reports, because at the time they had not checked the cameras on the freeways and other things. But for now, let's accept their report.
So the investigation is ongoing?
Yeah, it's ongoing.
Okay, all right. No, thank you so much, Deputy President, for your time.
I really
appreciate you coming here today.
Thank you, and good luck with your new approach.
thank you so much.
Communication, this is good.
Thank you so
you
much.
You have our support.
We appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Lovely, lovely.
This brings to the end our first episode. Until next time, goodbye.